Well, thank you for joining me today on Financially Speaking. My name is Mitch Slater. I'm a Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with UBS Wealth Management in Westfield, New Jersey. Where along with my partners, Ann and Crystal, we do our best to bring you advice beyond investing and address our clients' most challenging financial needs. It's my sincere hope that each and every episode of this podcast will educate you on personal finance and real-life business issues of the day. So let's jump right in. So I don't usually start my show going so deep and somewhat mystical, but with your permission, folks, I will on this episode. So last weekend, my guest today, two-time Emmy Award-winning and Grammy Award-winning director Tom Zimney, an editor, who through his films have normally brought me incredible joy and gratitude through capturing the passion and the beauty of the music I love so much, kind of crushed me. But he crushed me with honesty, artistry, and brought me to emotional places I never knew existed with his two latest masterpieces, Western Stars, which he co-directed with Bruce Springsteen, and The Gift, The Journey of Johnny Cash, which will be out exclusively on YouTube on November 11th. So without giving out any spoilers, there's just two particular moments that I kind of can't stop thinking about. In Western Stars, when Bruce sings the final song on the record, Moonlight Motel, a song when I first turned on the album, honestly, I liked it, but I didn't give much thought to it. But when Tom made this haunting live version of this song come alive in that incredible barn with ghostly-like echoes, I thought about how fleeting life really is. And then, watching The Gift and hearing Johnny Cash towards the end of his journey, with some of the most beautiful footage in the film as a backdrop, saying that life is human spirit, more than the godly spirit that's fighting for survival, and in the end, it's all fleeting. Yeah, that was pretty something. All right, I know that's pretty deep for a show called Financially Speaking, but man, Tom, you managed to take two legendary poets, musicians, and show us mortal folk what really matters. And I just want to start the show and just say thank you for that.
Well, first, thank you for inviting me on to this show. I've enjoyed for years your observations, either from social media or just our dialogue running into each other at shows. It's great to be here. And I really enjoy hearing your thoughts on both films, Western Stars and Johnny Cash, The Gift. These great gifts, forgive the pun, but as an experience, it was an amazing moment to listen to Johnny Cash and work with unreleased recordings and take in his deepest thoughts. And then simultaneously, you know, start a project with Bruce where he explored a lot of his writing of Western Stars and the themes in many ways that he talked about were a continuation of the book and the Broadway show. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really unique time in my journey as a filmmaker because I've had these two big projects happen simultaneously, and you can't help but reflect on your own life when you work with these guys.
Oh, absolutely. So as I've said many times, it seems like there never was a Garden of Eden, more like a Garden State Parkway, and that every cool story somehow seems to start in New Jersey. Maybe I'm a little biased, but for you, Tom, it was Point Pleasant, a Jersey Shore favorite. Tell us a little bit about your childhood, maybe any hints at a young age that you'd want to be a filmmaker?
I think when I look back, this music of Bruce especially was in my DNA. I grew up in the space of Point Pleasant, New Jersey, where the music that he was writing and talking about and the characters that he was referencing in albums like Darkness were all part of my existence. So it's a big part of my life, and it's a dream come true to be able to work with him and John. I had spent a lot of time in my childhood really looking at those lyrics and also being very interested in film and photography. And one of the first things I ever made was my own Born in the USA video.
Really?
In Point Pleasant. That was the beginning of my interest in trying to capture the power of Bruce's writing visually.
The first record that really hit you of his?
Now, the very first record that I connected to with Bruce was Darkness on the Edge of Town. And my brother came home from college, and I remember the font, I remember the lyrics, and I remember looking around my house in New Jersey and seeing my father, who was a construction worker, and realizing that this music was so close to my own experience. And
What did your folks do?
My father was a union carpenter, and my mom worked at a legal firm for the county at different points. So it was a lower middle class, by the shore existence that was really important to me to take in Bruce's music because he was bringing in details of the Jersey Shore life, but also with Darkness, I was really connecting deeply with some of the frustrations I saw my own father have and just some of the questions that I was just starting to ponder as an adolescent. And this idea of Badlands and Promised Land, really, the ideas in there really triggered me to want to be an artist and also pursue a life that was different than my father's. Mm-hmm. And I felt that theme was in the record. So I connected very deeply to it. I was a Bruce fan and I was also a Bob Dylan fan. And I think those two things drove me for a long time because I was dyslexic and I struggled with reading and writing, but I felt like this music was a secret messenger in many ways that gave me guidance.
Mm-hmm. And obviously a lot of other people have felt that way about Darkness, and in the recent Blinded by the Light, Safra's story there.
Absolutely.
Is just, you know.
Yeah, the place for identity.
It doesn't matter where you are in the world. Yeah. People have related to that. So let's fast forward a little bit. You went to the School of Visual Arts. Were you focusing on one area at that point?
I gathered up enough money to go to the School of Visual Arts, and I took a train every day from Point Pleasant for 2.5 hours each way.
Yeah, it's a long ride.
It was a huge ride, and I wanted to study film in New York. And the moment I got to School of Visual Arts and had this opportunity to really try film editing, I felt like I was connected to the world in a different way. The idea of putting two images together was really the beginning of the high of making films, you know. And I was surrounded by teachers and students who were really in the industry working every day, and they really supported me to find my place in the world with film. And at first it was editing, and then with Bruce, I found myself directing.
Right.
without any discussion.
So what directors spoke to you the most back then when you were in film school and really studying directors? Or did you have a couple that, not that you necessarily modeled your work, because your work is truly very unique, and I'm going to use you as an adjective here, or Zimney-esque, but it is what it is. But you know, was there a particular type of...
There's the filmmaker that I got into college writing about and discussing was Scorsese, and
okay.
That was a huge interest and reference for me, and it still is. I still go back to his films all the time to study the power of the cutting and composition and storytelling. And with Western Stars, I looked at The Last Waltz, and it's part of my library of go-to resources, and I really find it to be exciting to look at his documentary work because it's fearless in its editing and storytelling. You know, the Harrison film and the Dylan film, mm-hmm. are beautifully cut, yeah. And I find great inspiration in looking at all his films, from student films to Casino to the obvious ones like Goodfellas,
right.
But also, you know, some of his series on Italian cinema or
right.
American cinema I go
right.
to.
Right, amazing amount of work, and very excited about The Irishman coming up.
Yeah, I saw The Irishman, yeah, and I thought, yeah, it was fabulous,
yeah,
and
really,
it was a great experience to see it.
So you've kind of witnessed the revolution, or maybe the evolution, of so many ways of getting your message out other than traditional film and TV, and a great amount of disruption in your field, just like in most of our fields these days. But what do you think are the positives and negatives as we head into this new decade, and how interesting lately that Hollywood has seemed so fixated on these, you know, these rock star films, you know, where they kind of play with reality. I mean, one particular thing that just bugs me and I'll never get past it was in Rocket Man, when that famous troubadour show, Elton John is singing a song that he hadn't written for 3 years.
Yeah, I think, you know, the exciting thing for me as a filmmaker is to start with documentaries, and 10 years ago there wasn't a genre of music doc. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was, you know, doing Born to Run, that I would have to explain what it was as a documentary. And I think what's exciting now is that there are a lot of different filmmakers out there telling the stories of music and the history of music. And I think each one of these films approaches the facts and realities of it differently. And I tend not to fall into judging it too much. I really try to look at my own work. And with like Johnny Cash, the film out now,
right.
You know, there was a lot of details that I left out because I just felt they were covered in other movies. And there was a lot of details that I wanted to explore because I felt like the narrative films of Johnny Cash or some of the documentaries really painted certain things in simplistic terms. Vivian, his first wife,
right.
being the bad person.
Right.
You know, I just felt like there that was a complex relationship, and in the doc, I wanted to honor it. And I don't feel like it's the defining thing, but I do feel like you give these people a chance to really be represented in a true and honest way. And Vivian was a key point for me to tackle because I felt like she was background, and it just felt wrong. And also the idea of addiction with Johnny Cash and his journey, it wasn't something that was taken care of when he met June Carter and went away.
Right.
So there's a lot of illusions that you want to take down, and that's exciting.
It is.
So let's, same thing with Elvis Presley.
Yeah, of course. So let's just get into Johnny Cash, The Gift, The Journey of Johnny Cash, which everyone will be able to see on November 11th on YouTube. Kind of an obvious question, but what drew you to take on another immortal like Johnny Cash?
I mean,
after Elvis.
I mean, after Elvis, the idea of doing Johnny Cash, I loved the continuation of that story of in some ways, a lost father in the artist's life, and how that drives the artist. It's a common theme that I'm attracted to. And when I look at the work of Springsteen on Broadway, it's in there. And when I look at the work of Elvis, it's in there. Elvis's father going to prison and Elvis himself becoming the father figure in many ways. Johnny Cash had the same complexities with the father-son relationship. So that's an immediate interest to me. Obviously, the music I connected to deeply, but I also felt like that the narratives that were told with Johnny Cash in the past didn't reflect him as a songwriter or as an artist in many ways. I felt like there was the... you know, there's these cartoon representations of these guys.
Right.
You know, Johnny Cash is the man in black and that's
right.
it. And I sat with John Carter and I sat with Roseanne and then with this documentary, I got all these hours of unreleased recordings of Johnny, which was
amazing.
We'll
talk about that. That's really...
Yeah, that really changed the film for me. You realize the complexity of the Johnny Cash story and also that there's a lot of small details that get lost. So you hope as a filmmaker, bring those forward and leave behind some of the things that have been told again and again.
Right, and kind of layer it with this commentary from the likes of Bruce and Emmylou Harris and another many other artists, but I think specifically having Roseanne and, like you said, John Carter.
They both were essential.
So you were kind of heading in one direction, and then these cassettes sort of magically appeared?
Well,
what's the story behind that?
The story behind the unreleased cassettes was that I was in the middle of editing, and everyone gets to this place of not being happy with the film, and you feel betrayed by the film, and it's a relationship like any other relationship. One day you come in with your cup of coffee and it's not working and you're mad and you're disappointed with yourself. And I remember saying to the editor, I just don't like it. Unless I can get Johnny Cash in this room, I'm worried I'm not going to make the film I want. And he said to me, well, we've gone through every resource and we've collected, you know, 40 hours of Johnny Cash from every talk show and radio show.
Right.
What are you looking for? And I just said, Johnny Cash talking, the voice of Johnny Cash telling these stories, as opposed to a writer.
Right.
So the idea of like Johnny Cash discussing his childhood, you don't have a writer like a Warren Zanes or another Alan Light or any of those writers say, Johnny Cash suffered a tough childhood. I wanted Johnny saying it.
Exactly.
So I interviewed Patrick Carr, who was an author who made a book with Johnny Cash in the 90s. And at the end of the interview, he mentioned audio tapes. And at that moment, I knew I had something.
Yeah.
The archivist in me said, wait a minute. And we got over 50 hours worth of audio tapes of Johnny Cash telling his life story. And one thing Bruce Springsteen has taught me is to be ruthless in the editing process. And I had a whole movie built with other voices. And I tore that up and put Johnny's voice in the movie and reworked the movie with my editors. That was the game changer, was Johnny came to the edit room. Johnny arrived through cassettes. Johnny was telling his story, and that became the gift.
No, it is the gift, Johnny. It is truly the gift as the viewer. I mean, one of the things, and I imagine this came off the cassette, which really also hit me hard, was the gratitude list that Johnny Cash talks about later in his life. And
when you get this kind of intimacy in your films, like you had with Elvis and The Searcher, and obviously so much on Broadway with Bruce, in another very unique way in Western Stars, how does that affect you and maybe influence your process in cutting the film? Like I was saying, this is kind of the Zimney style. I mean, it really is, because it's followed through, you know, all of your work.
I think that I keep my world while making these films very tight and close, mm-hmm. meaning I don't have a team that's very expansive, and I really listen to the material, and the material that I'm interested in, for example, like Johnny Cash, having the gratitude list. I love the idea of ending something on a note that a viewer can just step into, that they don't have to know the history of Bruce or Johnny Cash or Elvis. They don't even have to be a fan. They just relate to the human side of it. And with the gratitude list, there was such beauty in Johnny Cash just listing the things in his life. And I thought that was a powerful message to have in the movie. And in many ways, it said everything about Johnny Cash, but it said nothing of the pop star. You know, it's... Mm-hmm. It was the most human reflection I could find of this man's journey that I was trying to tell in the film. So it just made total sense to stay. And I always go towards that zone. I'm interested in the journey of these artists and less the details of they did this record this year and the behind the scenes making of things. I'm much more fascinated with the ideas of what keeps us going, what struggles we have, and making it a universal story in a way that lets you understand your artist differently. Like Johnny Cash was weak, and Johnny Cash had to rebuild the trust with his family. Yeah. These are all common human themes, and really try to go towards archival images and stills that keep him in the place of being human, mm-hmm. and not an icon.
Right, and one of the things that I thought was so great is that you avoided the cliche hits. You know, this was not, if you're looking for a greatest hits, you know, listen to his greatest hits. This is, you really brought the gospel music to life, which was so important in Johnny Cash's life from his early days, from, you know, his conversations with his mother, from the loss of his brother. And then you kind of lace the whole backdrop of Folsom Prison behind it, and then sprinkled in, I mean, it's hard to have a favorite part of Johnny Cash's life, but the Rick Rubin period for me, those sessions were so incredible, and I'm so glad you included Further On Down the Road. You know, other than maybe Patty's Because the Night, that's probably one of my favorite Bruce covers, but what were some of the choices that, you know, you were faced with there?
You know, the choices of working with the catalog of Bruce or Elvis or Johnny Cash, you want to go to a place of what's driving the story, what's not a greatest hits moment. You know, there's many songs that I don't want to take the approach of traditional VH1, it's the greatest hit storytelling approach, where you start with the chorus and then it fades out gently. And I was very interested in going deep into the catalog and finding outtakes with Elvis. And the same thing with Bruce. When I do the documentaries, I really try to use as much of the outs and studio on release material as possible for the actual score of the movie. Because I feel like it's very exciting to watch a film and hear Suspicious Minds, mm-hmm. in a way that you've never heard.
Right.
Or the same thing with Johnny Cash, a TV rendition of a track that has the pure sonic beauty of a rough and ready television performance.
It's right. Not the, mixed the Bob Dylan.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, North Country. I mean,
exactly.
That was just the kind of a moment. And these are the kind of moments that you've kind of etched throughout your life working with Bruce, and you know, I think back obviously of the Sherry Darling moment of Bruce and Stephen on the piano,
sure.
which is just, as a fan, just an incredible thing to have just been in that room, as well as watching Bruce work.
Yeah,
on Wings for Wheels.
And that's a big part of it, is like keeping one foot in the world of the guy who grew up in Point Pleasant as a fan.
Yeah.
The other foot is a filmmaker trying to tell a story. You don't want to get too inside baseball. You want to be too caught up in your own fandom of it. But at the same time, there's certain beauty in in tracks that get lost.
Right.
And with Elvis, there was a ton. And with Johnny Cash, there was a ton. And none of these themes are really simple themes. Like Elvis and gospel and Johnny Cash and gospel, it's not a box just to check. It's really a thing to keep going back to. So when I looked at Folsom Prison, in a weird way, I looked at the set the way I would look at a Bruce set and go, what's the story? Mm-hmm. And with Folsom Prison, I saw a narrative that reflected Johnny Cash's life. There was the humor, there was the gallows humor, and there was the country, and there was the gospel. Everything is in that set list at Folsom
right.
that reflects the true Johnny Cash.
And then he wins the award.
Exactly. So Folsom Prison was a great reflection, but also a wonderful B story to tell the life story of Johnny Cash and return to Folsom, you know, going back and forth from A to B story. And if you think about it, it's like the A story could tell you how Johnny Cash grew up listening to gospel, how he connected to it. And then your B story of Folsom can just really play examples of that. And then the two worlds are combining.
Hmm.
You know, like you have an understanding why this man at Folsom sang a gospel song.
Right.
Because your other story's informing you. And so that breaks up the linear journey.
And I would imagine that's why both Roseanne and John Carter have been just the praise that I've already heard from them about the film.
Well, we both heard John Carter and Roseanne Cash were essential in getting an honesty and a quiet tone to the film that fit perfectly with the narrative of the story I was trying to tell, but also the sonic qualities of Johnny, which was honest on these cassettes, which was an honest examination of the life and the positive and the negative, but also the beauty and the family comes across in the film because they gave me a thing that you can never take for granted, which is trust and time. Mm-hmm. Trust and time are the two things that you need as a filmmaker. Trust to get into the space to talk about it, and time to figure out the movie.
Right. So before the listeners riot in the streets, and
yes.
You know, because I haven't talked about Bruce yet. I mean, obviously a huge moment in your professional life. Maybe just share the first story, what it was like getting to know him, you know, obviously after, like, you've already made your own Born in the USA movie, as you said. But after 20 years of being truly his film historian, I would think at this point you're kind of completing each other's sentences.
Well, you know, the dialogue in the cutting room is a great dialogue that started 20 years ago, but I also...
How were you first introduced to
him? First introduced to him, to back up on that.
Sorry. Yeah, sure.
I was first introduced to Bruce on a project called Live in New York.
Right.
And that was supposed to be a week, and it was a dream come true because I was in the audience and Live in New York watching the show at Madison Square Garden.
Yep, I was there every night.
And a week later, I was sitting in an edit room with the footage.
Yeah.
I literally found myself in the footage at one point cutting it. So it was a bit of a surreal dream from the perspective of a guy growing up in New Jersey, but I never let myself go down the road of really getting lost in that. I really stayed focused on the material and the challenge of the material. It was the early days of HD.
Right.
Bruce wasn't happy with the image quality. And he walked into the room and it was like when he gets on stage, there's complete command and focus. Mm-hmm. And I followed that lead. And it was an enjoyable time, but it was a very intense time. It was like very much like the studio sessions of Darkness where we were trying to figure out how to tell Live in New York in a way that didn't interfere with the music.
Mm-hmm.
Because the HD quality at that time was far too clear, too sharp. It was cold emotionally for the music.
It's very true.
And Bruce came in and we worked together side by side on that one. And that was the beginning. And John Landau, that was the beginning of a dialogue that I've been fortunate to have for the last 20 years.
Yeah, and obviously those films and box sets from Wings for Wheels to The Promise, to obviously all of the river work and, you know, For those of us that grew up like yourself with these bootlegs and my Winterland red vinyl and never saw Bruce appear anywhere on television or anything along those lines, this was seeing the New York concert after being there 10 nights or 12 nights, I think, for all of them. But there was just nothing like watching that and having the ability to just see over and over again. Land of Hope of Dreams for me is that, because that to me was so unique.
It was an amazing tour. Yeah, yeah. And with reflection, I went six times before I start working with Bruce. So I even wish I went more. You realize now the power and the beauty of that tour, and some of the people that are gone that we miss desperately, miss so much. And you know, I keep in my edit room up on the wall over there one of my early bootlegs, and Winterland was a huge reference for me, and I never forget that side of loving the music that much, that it was a secret messenger, these bootlegs and vinyl records, and you know, finding them was a huge task, and collecting the cassettes, but also, you know, stumbling on something of a concert that I would take in a way that it changed my life. I think of Live in New York that way, where I was suddenly in the space that I couldn't even let myself dream about as an adolescent. And and now working and collaborating with Bruce on Western Stars, it's the same thing where it's a dream come true. I just really always start from ground zero, whatever the next project may be. And right now we're at a space of there is no next project, but I hope to be part of the journey. And after 20 years, I don't take anything for granted. And you know, I just go back to work and try to enjoy these chapters, whether they're Springsteen on Broadway or each one you carry with your life.
And each one has a unique challenge. Obviously, the Springsteen on Broadway, you know, as we all know, kind of started at the White House, really, when Bruce started telling his stories. But I understand early on you saw the rehearsals at Monmouth, I think.
Yeah, John Landau was really, really important to me on that film, Springsteen on Broadway. He really gave me access to a lot of the conversations he was having with Bruce, but also the early rehearsals, and talked to me about the Obama show, and I watched it, and it was an amazing document to see. And he was also really part of the cutting room with me a lot more than Western Stars. So, you know, I think back on the beauty of Springsteen on Broadway is that we just took some new chances, and John was essential in that journey with me.
You know, one of the things that was just such a wise decision, obviously, having seen Bruce on Broadway, Springsteen on Broadway a couple of times, is that you weren't showing the crowd. And I think that to me was just such genius, because I think it made the viewer, especially those that were fortunate to see the show, it wasn't like I had the best seat in the house. Now I kind of felt like I was the house. I mean, I was on stage.
Well, it's great to hear. You hope as a filmmaker that you're not going to trample on the experience of the live Broadway show, which itself is such a big moment. At the same time, I know that from early on, my dialogue with Bruce, we'd talk about films, what we liked and what we didn't like. And if you look at Live in New York, we didn't show the audience in the same way.
I looked for myself. I remember looking and like, wait, come on.
There's no singing along.
But there was no pit. It was a very different kind of a setup, sure.
And with Broadway, there's no cut or shot of an audience member that could really enhance the dialogue of what Bruce was doing. And Bruce's eyes, I think, are really powerful in this narrative and really important. You know, remember, it's a guy on stage with a guitar and a microphone. We're not going anywhere. There's no huge set. There's no backgrounds. There's no, you know, there's beautiful lighting, and we try to make the camera a part of the environment. But it was really Bruce carrying it. So I never felt the desire to go backstage or the desire to cut it to an audience member engaging in it. Not until the very end, which was a great thing that John spotted and brought to my attention, which was there's a young guy at the very end. We don't know who he is, but you see at the end the feeling of community that Bruce creates. Right. And we stayed on that moment, and it's refreshing because it's the end of the show.
Right. And that's how the end of the show felt every night.
Yeah, and
exactly
him coming,
how it felt.
Yeah, and him coming to the front and greeting everyone, that was important.
Telling people to light it up, I think he would say, so they could, you know, take out their iPhones and you know, do whatever they want at that moment. And I think that kind of just captured it. And the other thing that's so fascinating is that I've heard from people that kind of never shared the passion and the love that I've had of his music over the years and couldn't understand maybe some of the appreciation, that this was their first experience. For example, my mother-in-law, who's 85 years old, and my brother, who loves music but just never quite understood the Bruce thing, so to speak. And my brother called me after watching Springsteen on Netflix and said, I get it. I get it now. I really do. I mean, wow. So, I mean, it's these
amazing moments. I'm grateful to hear those experiences. Yeah. And you know, if you can be in that space of being a small part of the journey of the music and then someone connecting to it, it's a great thing. And you know, I think like the gratitude list of Johnny Cash is an important thing for me to return to, which is, you know, I have tremendous gratitude for the past 20 years and you know, the experiences I had. And working on these films, you know, you have to step into your own life. You have to look at your own decisions. You know, watching Western Stars, it opens up a dialogue, internal dialogue, where you
think about your choices.
Right. And it's almost like I sense you're probably a bit of a history buff, because throughout all of these movies, whether it's The Gift, The Searcher, and even Western Stars, you're weaving in all of the issues of the day that the singers were facing, whether it was civil rights, drugs, FDA, you know, everything that managed to tell the story. And then all of a sudden, you've got the John Wayne moments.
Yeah.
In Western Stars. And
well, I love to represent the world that is in Bruce's music, especially, which is, you know, not one single location, right. And you know, the beauty of faces and all different races and men, women, children, and I find all that in the music. And with the documentaries like Elvis, I was quite aware of the Elvis story being told from one perspective, and I wanted to make sure that the influences in his life were clearly described and part of the environment and the fabric of the movie. I think race and the politics of the time and also delving into some of the fears of the time are really important to understand the music.
Oh, very much so. Speaking of Western Stars, if you have not had a chance, run, do not walk, and see this beautiful film. It really evokes the American West, the beautiful archival footage, the barn concert, which I apparently shot that over, shot it twice, two nights?
Two nights, yeah.
The concept of Bruce's poetic narration, I mean, was just heartbreaking.
Well, that came about, you know, we had built the film and we had a concert and I shot some interviews and it didn't feel like the direction that we wanted to take the movie. And one night Bruce called me up and just said, you know, come on by tomorrow. I want to read this script that I wrote for the film. And he sat in the recording studio and read every bit of voiceover that he had scripted. And I knew immediately we had a different film. It was at a different level, that the examination of the themes and the writing was exactly what the movie needed, which was getting away from a making of.
Right.
And getting into the language and the thoughts that really come from the book and the Broadway show. That dialogue continued in this genre of filmmaking.
You know, it changes everything. And as I said earlier, first of all, I can't wait for the release of the live album of the movie, because
Sonically is incredible.
Sonically is just, yeah. Every one of
that
those
barn,
songs. Yeah,
the barn captured that band in this amazing way. And Ron and Bob Clearmountain's mixes are just amazing. As a filmmaker, I have to just acknowledge, you know, like my cinematographer, Joe DeSalvo, captured imagery fantastic, and Jeff Rabbits with the lighting and
right.
the details he brings. My good buddy Kevin Buell, I couldn't make a film without him. Mm-hmm. Kevin is my spiritual advisor and good you know, friend of 20 years.
Sure.
But the sonic qualities that Bob Clearmountain got on the soundtrack and the mix itself was an amazing thing to have. I mixed it at Warner's with Bruce, with Kevin O'Connor. That was an amazing thing, because he brought us to a mixing stage that was Atmos, and this film has to be seen on a theater screen, and with this sound, it works that way. So,
and collaborating with Bruce, you said you did a little bit of that in the past, but obviously you were co-directors on this film.
Yeah, this one especially.
It was very hands-on.
Yeah, and we sat side by side, and I sat in the studio and built my little makeshift edit room right next outside his door, and I could hear him scoring and playing the guitar in the edit room and talking to me about edits. It was a great collaboration that way, and something that I couldn't dream up that, you know, I'd sit in the room with Bruce and we'd make a movie.
Amazing. Tom, I can't thank you enough for your time, your generosity today. The Gift, The Journey of Johnny Cash, which is a YouTube original film, will be available for streaming everywhere on the planet November 11th, and also includes a beautiful original composition, by the way, written and performed by Pearl Jam guitarist Mike McCready.
Yeah, Mike McCready is my hero, my friend, my composer. I hope for every movie that I work on, he's the best. He brought such an amazing sonic landscape to both Elvis Presley, The Searcher, and Johnny Cash, The Gift. Mike brings the movie to a whole other level and in many ways reminds me of Bruce with his focus and dedication and getting a sound, and his details in the studio are just, he really is essential to me in making these movies at this point.
So this has been a very busy couple of years. Obviously, we have a tour to look forward to in 2020 that will keep a lot of us busy, but I'm sure you'll be busy too.
I have nothing officially that I'm on, but it's good to be in this place of celebrating Western stars.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then when the phone rings, if it does, you know, I hope the film gods are there with me and I have my eyes open and my bootleg memories available and carry on.
Well, we look forward to it. Thanks again to Tom Zimney for appearing on my podcast. Don't miss The Gift on YouTube, Western Stars at a theater near you. Special thanks to Adrian Gerard for all of your help making this happen. Barbara Orion for help engineering today. Alex Ehrlich's done a little filming for us. And all, of course, the folks at Resonate who do tremendous editing on this podcast. That's all for this week. And remember, when it comes to saving for important things in life, like, let's say, an E Street Band tour next year, pay yourself first. Mitch Slater, have a great week.